Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, offering online bachelor completion programs, including business, education, nursing, and more. Information is available at viterbo.edu/completion.
There are few things as delicious as pure maple syrup. You drizzle it over pancakes. You know how I like it? I like it with vanilla ice cream. Oh, man, there's nothing better. I tell you what, it's a special ingredient. You can use it in cooking and baking. And people who produce their own syrup by tapping trees and processing the sap until it's that liquid gold are going to tell you that the process of making it is as addictive as the end result. And we're happy to have Michael Farrell with us today. He serves as the director of Cornell University's Eline Forest. It's a maple syrup research and extension field station, and it's located in Lake Placid, New York. And there he taps roughly 5,000 maples, about 600 birch trees, and a couple dozen black walnut and butternut trees every year. He earned his PhD in natural resources from Cornell University and is the author of the great book I have in front of me now. It's called The Sugar Maker's Companion, an integrated approach to producing syrup from maple, birch, and walnut trees. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, we tap a few trees here in Wisconsin, too.
Well, I know that. And in fact, I was out in Wisconsin. I was in Wausau this past January for the annual meeting. And I got to meet a lot of producers and see a lot of your state there.
It's a wonderful state, and there's a lot of really good maple syrup produced here. I don't think there's ever a time when there isn't at least one bottle of maple syrup in our refrigerator or on the shelf. We absolutely love it. Where did you?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, did your interest in tapping trees come from?
Well, I learned about it when I was in grad school studying forestry. You know, I grew up on the Aunt Jemima or the Mrs. Butterworth,
like most of us.
Yeah, and so I didn't know about pure maple syrup, but I was very interested in forests and forestry, managing our forest, and just so happened that we got a chance on one of our field trips to check out the College of Sugar Bush and went to a pancake breakfast there, had their own pure maple syrup, and it was unbelievably delicious. I decided then I got to try making it myself.
Well, I tell you what, it's a great book. And in your book, The Sugar Maker's Companion, it doesn't just cover producing syrup from maple trees, but what I found interesting as well was also birch and walnut. Is that process and the product differ?
The process is very similar. Basically, you know, drilling holes into these trees in the springtime, collecting the sap, and then boiling it down. So the process is very similar. So if you know how to make maple syrup, you can certainly make birch or walnut syrup. But there's, of course, different intricacies in how the sap flows and how you process the sap that makes it a little different. And of course, the flavors are a lot different as well because they're different trees.
Yeah. Do you like the flavor of walnut, for example?
Not only me, but, you know, we've done research and they did some research at Kansas State University. People like the taste of walnut syrup just as much as maple syrup. There was no difference in the likability scale between those two syrups. And they taste fairly similar. Of course, they have their own unique flavors because they're different trees, but they're both mostly sucrose in the sap, so they caramelize at the same consistency and at the same temperatures, whereas the flavor of birch syrup is much different.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it tastes nothing like maple syrup, nothing like walnut syrup, and it has more of a fruity molasses type of flavor. It's nothing you'd put on pancakes. It's something you'd be cooking with. You'd use it as an ingredient in fine cuisine. That's what it's mostly used for.
I got to lay my hands on some of the birch and the walnut because I've never tried either.
Well, you're not alone. I mean, very few people have. And there's not a lot of people producing syrup from these trees, and just not a lot of, you know, syrup being made. So very few people have ever gotten the chance to try it. But, you know, that's why I wanted to include as much information as I could about tapping these other trees in the book, because, you know, I think just as there's incredible opportunities with, you know, expanding maple production and producing, consuming more maple syrup, there's also these great opportunities to tap additional trees as well.
And you might just give a thumbnail of your book, which I really like it because you've got such great photographs in with it, along with some pretty darn clear writing, so that any of us are going to, you know, easily be able to read and understand what you're writing about. But talk a little about the book.
Okay, yeah. It's called The Sugar Maker's Companion, and I spent the last few years writing it. It came out this past fall. You know, it's something that I really enjoyed doing. It's, you know, it's easy to write about something when you love what you're writing about. And, you know,
yep.
You know, so I was also trying to finish my PhD at Cornell at the same time, so I had to write my dissertation as well. But I always took a break to, you know, when you're sick of writing your dissertation, it's a lot easier to write about the book. So
I know that. I had the same feeling when I was writing mine.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anything to avoid.
Yeah, right. And, you know, so they asked me, Chelsea Green Publishing asked me to write this book, and I told them, well, you know, that sounds great. I'd love to do it, but, you know, I'm trying to finish my dissertation. That's my number one thing I have to do. I did that as part of my employment at Cornell. I run the Maple Research Center, but one of the benefits of working with Cornell and for the university is that they let me also pursue my degree at the same time, which was nice, and you know, I'm very fortunate. But, you know, that takes a lot of time in addition to regular jobs. So I just asked them for more time to do it, and they were gracious, allowed me to do it. So, you know, it was really fun doing it. I tried to include as much information as possible for people who, I mean, my target audience was people who wanted to do it as more than just a hobby. I mean, it's got all the information in it if you just want to do it as a hobby. But if you're trying to earn some income from it, you know, generate some sustainable revenue over time, that's the kind of information I thought was lacking out there in the maple world. So, I geared. That was when you're thinking about your audience. That was my audience, was somebody who wants to get started in a sugaring operation and wants to have fun doing it and have it profitable and sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have another degree in economics, too, but both economics and forestry, man, that's a perfect combination for running a sugaring business.
I was fortunate. I, you know, like most, you know, students going into college, they don't know what they want to study. I just chose economics because I had some interest in it. It turned out to be very useful. You know, I didn't want to do the Wall Street thing. I experimented a little with that, but I didn't like it, so I went back for forestry school. But, you know, forestry is just the economics of trees. You know, economics is how to make the best use of scarce resources, and there's lots of theories. And you know, behind that, economic 101 basically applies not just to the markets, but to forestry, to agriculture, to maple syrup.
We have listener George. He's another guy out sturgeon spearing, but from his shack. Would like your opinion on boiling versus a reverse osmosis process.
Okay. Sure.
He said he also wanted to see that box elders. You can tap box elders for sugaring too.
Sure. Yeah, they call that box elders, also known as Manitoba maple. That's what they have up in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, that area.
Yeah.
Out on the prairie, those are the only maples that'll grow, and so they tap those. And lots of people doing it and having good success. So, you know, any species of maple, there's 120 species of maple throughout the world. We're fortunate that we have sugar maple. And a lot of red maple here in the eastern U.S. and Canada. So those are the two primary ones. But, yeah, if you have the right weather and maple trees or birch or walnut, you can make syrup from lots of different trees. In regards to the question about reverse osmosis, I'm a big advocate of that technology. It has it's what allowed the maple industry to really expand over the last 30 years. Basically, what the process is pumping the sap with a high-pressure pump against the membrane that separates the water from the sugars in the sap. You know, the sap from maple trees is only 2% sugar, and so that's why it takes 40 gallons of sap to boil down to 1 gallon of syrup. It takes a lot of time, a lot of fuel. When you can reduce that by about 80 to sometimes 90% by first removing 80 to 90% of the water by pumping it through the membrane first, that's a big savings in time and fuel. It's economically efficient, environmentally friendly, and you know they even have small RROs now as well.
That's an amazing process. Ron in Newburgh has a question for you, too, that relates, I think. Ron, hi.
Yes, a week ago on Wisconsin Public Radio, they had a organization up in New Hampshire or something like that specializing in maple syrup, and they have a new process of planting a whole bunch of small maple trees out in the openings, and then they put a vacuum pump on the top and suck the water out of the top of those small trees. Does that actually work?
Well, that's that was developed at the University of Vermont, some researchers there. It's in the prototype, you know, stage. They're in the exploration, the research and development stage. It's possible. I mean, yes, it can work. I mean, you can cut the top off a small sapling, put a vacuum system onto that, and then suck the sap out of the sapling. So it's technically feasible. What they're exploring now is, you know, how to do this on a large scale, and the economics of it is the big question. From my perspective, does it make sense economically to invest all that time and money and resources into planting these dense plantations and then managing them so intensively? It requires a large outlay. You don't get the returns for many years, and it's a lot of labor. So this is a method that they've developed for potential expansion in the future. Lots of people are, you know, curious about it, and I'm sure some people will be experimenting with it. It's a big change in the way you would think about making maple syrup. I mean, all of it right now is made primarily from wild forest. I mean,
yep.
Some people are planting trees that have been planted in yards and along roads, but for the most part, it comes from the woods, from existing mature trees, and you just drill a small hole in the tree every year.
Yeah.
To collect the sap. So this is a completely different way of doing it. It's technically feasible, but nobody's doing it yet on a commercial scale, and you know, time will tell
whether that's going to happen. Yeah. Michael Farrell, our guest today, serves as director of the Cornell University's Eline Forest, a maple syrup research and extension field station in Lake Placid, New York. He's the author of The Sugar Maker's Companion. And he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. Take a look at the news, and then we'll be back with Michael Farrell. Among other signs of spring, one is when the sap starts running. The trees are tapped, and the sap is collected. And also to make that wonderful, rich, and complex syrups that we love. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Pure maple syrup, a real treat, and we're learning how to do it from Michael Farrell. He directs Cornell University's Eline Forest. It's a maple syrup research and extension field station in Lake Placid, New York. He taps about 5,000 maples, 600 birches, and a couple dozen black walnut and butternut trees every year. PhD in natural resources from Cornell. And he's the author of The Sugar Maker's Companion, an integrated approach to producing syrup from maple, birch, and walnut trees. And once again, Michael, thanks for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here, Larry. Thank you.
Jim in Colfax has a question for you, and I'm just going to go right to him. He's been waiting a long time. Jim, thanks for waiting. Hello. Jim, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can.
Okay. I've talked to you once before, Larry, about this great property I have, and I have all these walnut trees, and I always asked about the gardening part. Well, this is unique because I didn't know you could tap a walnut tree. I have about 30 black walnut trees, and I'd just like you to give me a little bit more information on it. Sounds like your book would probably explain everything I would need to know, but I think it would be fun to be able to tap these walnut trees. They're not very far apart, and They're from great big ones to little ones. They've been kind of been taken over on their own for the last 40 years the property hasn't been lived on since 1957, and the squirrels have done a great job of transplanting many of them for me.
Okay. Well, what do you think, Michael?
Well, I mean, that's a, it's a great situation to have that many walnut trees. Not many people do, especially maple syrup producers, because in much of the, you know, U.S., there's a lot of maples, but not nearly as many walnuts. And so they're more rare to find, especially in the traditional maple syrup country where you have a lot of maples. So if you have 40 trees, I would definitely, you know, tap them and try to make some syrup from it. What you should expect to get is less sap than you would get from maple trees. The walnuts don't produce as much sap as the maples, but the sugar content is usually about the same. You'll still have about that 40-to-1 ratio with walnuts as you do with maples. And the other difference in walnuts versus maple, and there's a lot of variation I've noticed and heard from other people, but you might find a lot of naturally occurring pectin in the sap, the pectin that people use to make jams and jellies.
Interesting.
So we filter that out before we boil it so that it turns into this consistency of syrup and not jelly. I did some experiments without filtering it first, and I actually made some walnut jelly. Kept all the pectin in it. So if you want to make syrup and not jelly, you got to filter it.
Does your book explain that?
Yes. Yep.
Oh,
And so, you know, that's the those are the two main differences in tapping walnuts versus maples.
All right.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. That sounds cool. They're all close together. It would be easy to harvest it, not tromping through the woods, you know, steep hills and everything else where I live. I think you just sold another book. That's great.
Thanks. And the book title again is The Sugar Maker's Companion by Michael Farrell, An Integrated Approach to Producing Syrup from Maple, Birch, and Walnut Trees. There you go, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. We had an email from Samara, who's in Oshkosh, who is really enjoying the show as she cooks dinner for 12. She said, just a quick story to share. Growing up in Lebanon during its civil war, anything foreign was precious. My American mother was delighted to find that our small grocery store carrying American and European goods had real maple syrup in the small bottles priced lower than the manufactured variety in the large bottles. I think she bought the whole case. We ate lots of pancakes and waffles in the following months. That's a great story.
Okay, so she was referring to this to the Civil War here in the U.S.?
In Lebanon.
Oh, in Lebanon. Oh, okay, right, yeah.
That is very cool.
Yeah, well, when I heard Civil War, I didn't catch the Lebanon part, but, you know, an interesting story here of our Civil War history here in the U.S. is that was actually the height of maple syrup production, maple sugar production in the U.S. was during the Civil War.
Is that right?
Because the Northerners, you know, of course, didn't get along with the South. They didn't want to get any what they called slave sugar out of the South. And that cane sugar coming from and down south and from the, you know, the Caribbean islands, they weren't going to take any of that as a source of pride as well, you know, it's just that was the staple source of sugar here for the Northeast. You know, everybody, you know, at that point, there were a lot more people living on the land, you know, a lot of subsistence farmers and people, you know, earning, you know, what they could sell or the food that they grew themselves. And maple was the staple source of sugar. You know, we didn't have high fructose corn syrup at that point. We weren't really importing cane sugar. There wasn't lots of beet sugar around. There was some honey. So you really either had maple sugar or honey. And so, you know, people saved their maple trees when they were clearing the rest of the forest for agriculture and for fuel wood. They saved the maples and they tapped them every spring. And, you know, we used to make a lot more maple sugar back then than we do today.
Interesting.
But, you know, but now today we have a lot more trees on the landscape. You know, our forests have come back, primarily the sugar and red maple. Those are two of the top tree species. throughout the eastern U.S., and we have, you know, the technology now, it makes it a lot easier. So with all these extra trees we have, technology that makes it pretty much like night and day compared to the way it used to be. I mean, it's not easy work now, but compared to trying to make it back in the 1800s with the technology they had then, it's amazing what they were able to do.
Yeah.
But we could certainly be producing and consuming more maple like we did back in the 1800s.
Great story. Kyle in Madison has a comment. Kyle, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, no problem. When I was a child in the 70s in Madison, we used to have a field trip every year to the maple syrup farms in the area. And also, listening to your show, it turns out I have land in the Western Sierra that has a maple-looking tree on there, or the leaf is maple-looking. The tree is really tall and diameter. It's huge. We have a number of them. And you're telling me I can tap those that have a maple-type leaf? I believe it's a maple tree.
Sure. So this is the Western Sierras, like the Western U.S.?
Yes.
Yeah, so most likely that is big-leaf maple. And there's a lot of people producing big-leaf maple syrup out in the Western U.S. and Western Canada now. A guy came out with a book called Big Leaf Sugaring, Tapping the Western Maple. He told me he's already sold 3,000 copies of it.
Wow.
And they have this festival in Vancouver Island called, you know, the Big Leaf Maple Syrup Festival. People basically just learned about it in the last, I'd say, 10 years or so since they've been doing it. And it's growing like crazy. You know, when people find out that they can do sugaring as well, it's just, you know, he described it to me as like people finding out they just got a new toy. everybody wants to use it. Right? Because there's lots of big leaf maples out there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what they struggle with is not having enough cold temperatures. You know, it's a temperate rainforest type of environment.
Yeah.
Where, you get cold temperatures, but it's not like the East or the Midwest where you have a severe winter. And then spring, it's throughout the winter whenever they get temperatures above freezing during the day. But, you know, following a night of freezing weather or a couple of days of freezing weather, that's when you get the sap flowing. And that's what they look for, you know, out in the West.
We have Tim in Eau Claire with a question that, let's see if I'm going to get him on here. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is, with the prevalence of all of the moonshine shows that we see now, there's obviously a lot of home distillers out there, you know, with the varying, degrees of legality. But I know Wisconsin, you can distill up to a point. You know, you can make your own alcohol. My question is if people are making alcohol out of the maple syrup, or if they're making alcohol out of the, you know, sap that comes out of the maple, or, you know, if there's any places out there that are already making it so we can...
Sure,
sure.
Yeah, there's, you know, maple being a sugar, you can do lots of things with it. And one of them is fermenting and distilling, and there's...
You got a photo in your book of one, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, yeah. I tried to highlight some different operations that I've known myself or come across that I thought were really successful. You know, it's an expensive product. You know, maple is one of the most expensive sugars because it's so time and fuel intensive to produce it. So if you're going to take maple syrup and then distill it down into alcohol, that's going to be a very expensive alcohol. So oftentimes it's used for flavoring other types of distilled alcohols, or it's used in brewing. You know, at the Lake Placid Pub and Brewery, we supply them with maple sap. They make a maple sap beer. Just replace the water with sap, and it's a delicious beer. We also do the same with birch sap, where you give them birch sap and they make a birch beer with that. You can make a wine out of it. There's a guy in started a company up in Canada, uses, I think, about 2 million pounds of maple syrup a year to turn into maple wine. And one of his biggest markets is China. They love maple wine in China. And so there's all sorts of things you can do with it. And, you know, if I was going to distill it, I would use the stuff from the end of the season. You know, at the end of maple season, when the trees are turning, the sap turns buddy, when the buds are starting to swell,
yep,
and the chemistry of the sap changes and the flavor of the syrup is no longer desirable. People don't like the taste of it for good reason. So you can take that syrup, that buddy, off flavored syrup and try that for distilling. That's what I would use if I wanted to, you know, distill some alcohol from it.
Cabin Fever Whiskey uses pure maple syrup. You had a picture of Cabin Fever in your book.
Yes. Yeah, they do. And then, you know, the big news over the past year or so is Crown Royal came out with a maple whiskey, but unfortunately they didn't use real maple. They used artificial flavors.
Ah!
I was really disappointed to see that because it's very deceptive on their label.
Wow.
It says maple finished, but it's just maple artificial maple flavoring added to their whiskey, which I was disappointed to see that. There's a lot of that kind of stuff in the marketplace. You know, the International Maple Syrup Institute is always looking to try to protect the maple name because people, you know, with maple being such a great name, a great brand, and great flavor, there's lots of imitations out there, and we want to promote pure maple, not the artificial.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Benjamin and Madison has a question for you. Hi, Benjamin. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks a lot. My question is somewhat economics related and physiologically related to walnuts. If a lot of people, especially in western Wisconsin, which is a good walnut climate, are growing trees specifically for high quality wood production. And what is the effect of tapping on the quality of the wood that you're going to get from those trees?
That's a good question. I have with Chuck in McHenry, Illinois, asked the same question. He's got a stand of walnut.
Yeah, I get that question all the time. So, you know, I have yet to, because this is relatively new, I have yet to see any walnut trees that have been tapped, then cut down and turned into lumber. So my answer is based on just what I know from happens with maples, and I assume the same would happen with walnuts, but we just got a research grant funded to look at this question because it is of very high importance, because maples are valuable for timber, and so are walnuts, sometimes even much more so than maples. And so there's always that question of the economic trade-off of using them for syrup or for lumber production. Now,
that was really my basis for this question, because a lot of people that run a sugar bush, that maple, I mean, your goal is big maple trees, so it's sugar bush primarily, not a timber situation. And most walnuts out there in the landscape today are, you know, planted for a timber reason, not for a syrup reason. So.
Yeah.
Oh, right, yeah. So if you have very high-quality walnut trees that are going to be sold for veneer, and you've been managing them and taking care of them, pruning them, and you have nice, clear, straight walnut logs, you know, chances are you should probably just continue to manage them for timber production and get that veneer quality log off those trees. That's going to be economically much more viable. Now, there's also lots of walnuts out there, and I talked to many different people who have walnuts who they don't plan on cutting them down. Or they're misshapen, or you know, they're not perfect, clear veneer logs. In that case, then you don't have to worry about the economic trade-off of tapping versus timber production. What happens to the lumber with maple trees? When you drill a hole in the tree, it creates a wound, and the tree wants to seal off that wound. So it and there's a streak of discolored. Pretty much like the heartwood, up and down, maybe 8 to 12 inches up and down from that hole. And it creates different patterned lumber. We call it tap hole maple lumber. I featured it a lot in the book because it's an incredible opportunity in the maple industry for people to turn those tapped logs into valuable lumber for niche markets once they're no longer useful for sugaring. We sell the tapped lumber and the tapped logs for more than clear lumber. Because it's got that great story behind it, and every board is unique. With walnuts, there's no tap hole walnut lumber, right? It just doesn't exist yet. But if you were to tap your walnut trees and create those stained columns of wood, and you know the valuable part of walnut lumber is that inner dark heartwood. That's what people are looking for. That's what's prized, not the outer white sapwood. you know, physiology of the tree has both heartwood and the inside, which is not conducive for sap flow, and just a thin layer of sapwood on the outside, maybe a couple inches thick. That's where the sap is. And so when you drill a hole in the walnut tree, that's going to create a wounding response, and you're going to develop more dark heartwood around that hole. And so when it eventually gets sawn up, you're going to, if it's like a maple, and I have no reason to believe it wouldn't be, you're going to have those stained columns streaks up and down in the white sapwood, which will create some very unique and beautiful figured lumber.
I like that.
You know, if you're selling the logs to a log buyer, they're not going to be impressed with your tap holes. Okay? They want clear logs. If you're going to be sawing them up yourself, or if the trees aren't of the highest saw timber quality, then those are the ones that would be best for tapping.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben. Carl in Rushford, Minnesota. Hello.
Oh, hey. So one spring, my brother cut a bunch of hickory rounds and stacked them in the shed. Several weeks later, I'm back there. What's this white stuff around the inner bark? And then find that's hickory. This sugar was confectionery sugar. Also, I had one coffee can on a silver maple tree that was full, and a blizzard hit, and I took the ice out, and here it's syrup in the bottom. Now, is it a trying to think of how it's economical to make syrup by freezing?
Oh,
like I can concentrate vinegars or cider or fortify wine by freezing.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, I mean, you can do that. I mean, the Native Americans used to, and probably the early settlers as well, used to, you know, let the sap sit overnight, throw out the ice that formed out overnight, and then boil the concentrated sap the next day. So that's called freeze concentration. It's certainly viable on a small scale. On a large scale, we just don't have the technology. But,
yeah,
you know, if you're collecting sap in buckets, yeah, definitely throw out the ice. There'll be a little bit of sugar trapped in the ice, but not that much. It's mostly water. And so you can, you know, on a small scale, you know, increase your efficiency, reduce your boiling time by doing that. It's very hard to, the energy requirement to get it all the way to syrup would be
very
difficult.
Yeah.
But you can get it, you can get it closer. But to get that maple flavor too, it has to go under heat. It's that Maillard reaction. It's called the caramelization of the sucrose under heat. That creates the maple flavor.
Ah, there you go. Thanks, Carl. Roy in Appleton, hi.
Hi, how are you? I just was listening to you on and off, but a couple comments. One year we found a red squirrel in one of our sap pans, and my son froze it, took it to UWGB, and it turned out to be a collection now in the Richter collection at the university because it was well beyond its normal range. But the other thing we've done is we have made wine out of maple, out of birch sap. It makes a wonderful wine, almost like a Chablis.
Ah, there you go, Michael.
Yeah, yeah, and there's several people making the birch wine. There, you know, I featured one. This one company is doing it on a large scale. The Lady of the Woods is, or Spring Wine is the name of it, his birch wines. He's doing up in Newfoundland, and you know, in the rest of the world, that's what they have is a lot of birch trees, and they do. They drink a lot of birch sap and make birch wine. And so it's definitely something, you know, I'm glad to hear you're doing it. And, you know, something, you know, lots of people can experiment with.
How many trees do you need to make it worthwhile?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think if you just have one tree, it's worthwhile just to tap the tree, just to drink the sap and to cook with the sap. It's a delicious beverage, very good for you. And it's also a great cooking ingredient. So even with just one tree, it's worthwhile to tap it. If you're trying to do it for you know, a business and trying to earn some money from it, I'd say you need, at the very minimum, maybe 500 trees before it starts to get economically you know, viable. I mean, if you only have a few hundred trees, chances are it's going to be a hobby.
Michael, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much. I'm really enjoying your book. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Michael Farrell is the author of The Sugar Maker's Companion, and it's a really interesting book. I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. And if you're interested in volunteering, the McKenzie Center needs some volunteers for their sugaring that's going on. We have more on my Facebook page, so just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you'll learn more about the volunteering for sugaring at the McKenzie Center. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.